Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. In our first segment, we'll look at the areas of conflict around the world and the options that world leaders have to address them. And in our second half hour, we'll learn about the economic and political crisis in Venezuela. There, inflation is soaring and street violence is escalating. We start with Rob Malley. He's CEO of the International Crisis Group, and he's the former senior director of President Obama's National Security Council. The organization he now leads reports on and seeks to resolve crises around the world before they turn deadly, or to resolve those crises once they do. Rob will be in conversation with my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis, who recently sat down with Rob Malley of the International Crisis Group.
What you're telling me is that you do an incredible number of op-eds. I mean, if anyone's paying attention to some of the larger news organizations around the world, you'll see crisis group op-eds or analyses that are published on a regular basis. I think that's a big part of what you do. What is it then that separates you from, say, a journalistic organization? They also provide the types of things that you're saying to CIA and to state and to the administration.
So, and it's interesting because when I try to describe who we are, so we're not a think tank in the sense that we don't, you know, think tanks don't take a position. Brookings, Council on Foreign Relations, others. It's almost like an academic institution. People do great work. For the most part, they are based in the U.S. So our two distinctive factors, if we have people on the ground and we take a position, we are activists. We tell governments, and often we get governments to pay us to tell them what they don't want to hear and to tell them to do what they would rather avoid doing. And that's, you know, a journalist in theory doesn't do that. Some editorialize and do that. That's fine. But, you know, we have an organization. We manage to have access to leaders around the world, to decision makers around the world. So many of the people that we hire, by the way, come from a journalistic background, and they may just want to have a different platform. You know, I come from a family of journalists, so the last thing I'm going to do is say anything negative about journalists. I love journalists. But I think we are a mix of three things: journalism, and we have sort of the immediacy of journalism and the field-based ground truth of journalism. Academia, because we really have people who are experts in their field. The people who follow Syria have years and years of experience on Syria. The people who follow North Korea have spent a lifetime writing about North Korea. And also policymakers, because we want people in the organization who can translate what you find on the ground in words and ideas that decision makers can then implement. So we're a mix of all three, but we're not any one of those exclusively.
You're not just talking about the policy. You're talking about how do members of your team understand ultimately the politics.
Right. And as I say, that's where we try to come up. And it's a struggle because, you know, people come up with ideas that are often great, but just not practical. You have to understand the constraints under which governments operate, the pressures, both the political pressures and just the practical pressures of having other countries that are going to push back. It's not just a matter of snapping your fingers and things get done. So there's a degree of realism and pragmatism that we marry with an ethical and moral view about how the world should be. And it's that intersection which makes us, again, somewhat different from others. And we could go through, I'm sure we will, specific examples of where we try to be as realistic as we could be, but not at the service of any nation state. Our realism is at the service of the victims of conflict, who are predominantly civilians, men and women who have nothing to do with the fighting, and the fighting is often done in their name, unfortunately.
Right. Men, women, and children, and of course, children, the most vulnerable of all the classes of those who are caught in civilian conflict. Let's take Iran, Saudi, if that's a fair characterization of a framework of conflict that's occurring today. How does then ICG approach the players within that? Because it seems that they're dominantly state players and it's a fairly pyramidal power structure with some sub-players, whether they be terrorist organizations or some semi-credible and legitimate political organizations within Lebanon or elsewhere labeled as terrorist organizations. How do you engage? How do you get into that mess?
So that's the first step, and you put your finger on it, which is deconstructing the conflict. Trying to figure out not just who all the players are, the interactions between those players. I mean, one of the things that we're doing in our organization is making the point that what could start in Yemen could then very quickly spill over in Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia with Iran, which could spill over into Iraq, which could spill over into Syria, which could spill over into Israel. There really is a connection, and we try to map that out. In fact, on our website, you could find the mapping of all how those conflicts are interrelated. People could sit here and say, "Oh, the Iranians just won't expand," or "Saudi Arabia is just a retrograde nation that doesn't that wants to maintain a certain form of rule." Both those things only say so much, and often don't say much at all. These countries are driven by national interests, sometimes ideological interests, but you have to understand what those interests are if your goal is to address them, not always surrender to them, but understand where they're coming from, and then try to find ways of mitigating the risk of conflict that derive from those interests. So, you know, yes, Iran is engaged in activities that are very troubling to the United States, Israel, to Saudi Arabia. It's not just because they want to do it. They're not doing it just for the sake of doing it. They have their own self-perception about the threat that they're under. So they're trying to project a national security doctrine by, in their case, sort of pushing their borders as far from Iran as possible. So their security borders. So they have proxies in Iraq. They have proxies in Lebanon. They have or allies in Lebanon. Proxies in Syria. And they're trying to push the conflict as far away from their own borders because they do feel threatened. So not justifying their behavior in any way. But unless you understand the security source from which their behavior arises, you're never going to be able to resolve it. It's just going to be a perpetual conflict because Iran won't give in. They'll just fight back. And again, that's what we're seeing across the region. So what we do with that is once we've mapped out the conflict and the conflict players and the interests that motivate them, then we go talk to people in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, in Israel, and we try to explain to them what we've found. And sometimes they do want to hear it and they want to listen because it helps them better understand the attitudes of those who they're fighting. And I'll tell you, you know, the three biggest sources of tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia, between Iran and the United States, and between Iran and Israel. In all the three of those cases, there's virtually no interaction between the players, between Iran and the United States. Since President Trump came into office, there's virtually no contact. Iran and Saudi Arabia, they barely talk to each other. Iran and Israel, likewise. So they don't know each other. They don't really know what's motivating. And what they do is they project their worst fears and their worst images of their adversary. And that's how they conduct their policy. If they don't have a grounded sense of why Israel is behaving the way it does, or why Hezbollah is behaving the way it does, why Iran is behaving the way it does, then you can't have a policy that's appropriate.
In almost all administrations previously, and in all relationships previously, there seems to be this, what's often called in diplomacy, a second track, where you have non-governmental players or proxy players who are allowed to go in and to have these discussions. Is that just completely absent in today's reality?
No. I mean, track two diplomacy, in which we engage in every now and then ourselves as crisis group, which is non-officials, that does take place to some extent. But and that's very useful, by the way. But what I'm saying is that there's no official contact. So, you know, one of the things that the Obama administration did is that it normalized contacts between senior officials from Iran and from the United States. Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Zarif, the Iranian Foreign Minister, spoke to each other probably as much, if not more, than Secretary Kerry spoke to any other foreign minister,
right,
and for good reason. So you that managed to diffuse some crises much more quickly than if you don't have that direct interaction. Mm-hmm. So my point is not that we could really substitute for it, but what we do and what others do is try to inform the U.S. administration, Iranian officials, Israeli officials, here's what the other side is saying and thinking. You may believe it, you may not believe it, but at least understand their perspective. That does happen. Again, track two diplomacy happens sometimes, but we try to document it as much as possible, not because what we do is not simply talk to the leaders. We go to the country, we speak to an array of officials. As you say, these are dynamic societies. I'll give you an example from a completely different region, North Korea, where we have just done a series of reports. Understanding the domestic impetus behind what the North Korean leader is doing. It's not only about threatening us or threatening South Korea. It's also a means for Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, to establish his own legitimacy, to make sure that he's consolidating his own power. And understanding that decisions that people make sometimes have sources that are completely surprising. I mean, people may, you look at something and you mirror image. You imagine that they're behaving the way they're behaving because that's the way you might behave.
Right.
But sometimes it comes from domestic sources, from their own paranoia or their own insecurity. The case of North Korea, a country that for 50 or more years has lived under the shadow of the possible, as they see it, the possible military intervention by the United States. You have to take that into account, again, not to justify in any way the behavior of Pyongyang, but to understand what are the sources of their behavior. Because I, you know, our philosophy is that people don't act for irrational reasons. Most leaders have their own rationality, which we may not be very familiar with or understand, but it has a rationality. Understanding what that rationality is will help a lot in terms of figuring out how to react to it.
So on the point of rationality, you know, one would also then apply the same to the United States in looking at the current administration and maybe come up with a different argument, which is to say, you know, in the lack of relations and dialogue with North Korea, although there has been recently an opening to some mm-hmm. level of dialogue, but I think the argument can also be made to, and is being made, in fact, by those who are supportive of the president's position, that in fact this highly risky, very dangerous approach that he's taking is actually leading to a result that Crisis Group would be interested in, which is the prevention of conflict. How do you respond to that?
So it's a very good question. We're not, you know, by nature opposed to pressure. You know, pressure has its place in any form of diplomacy. But it has to be married with giving the country you're pressuring a way out. Our critique of the Trump administration, it may be too soon to say, is that they're not really leaving the North Koreans at this point an exit ramp. And so if you put a lot of pressure on them, I think experience has shown the North Koreans are not going to buckle under that pressure unless they, you know, if they see a way out, they may take it. But otherwise, they'll just double down. And so far, the pressure has not led to a let up in North Korea's missile or nuclear program. And if the Trump administration is serious that it has this red line that if North Korea acquires the ability or is close to acquiring the ability to reach the continental United States with a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile, if they're serious that they would go to war in order to prevent that, then we could be on the verge of a war whose implications would, you know, dwarf anything we've seen in a very, very, very long time. So our plea there is not stop the sanctions, stop the pressure. It's engage. You could keep the sanctions on, but engage and talk about a realistic outcome. If the outcome is denuclearization, immediate denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, not going to happen. Again, for reasons that one has to understand and one could understand if one studies North Korea, they're not going to do that. It's not possible. But you could take other steps, interim steps, to get there, which won't satisfy the Trump administration's position as it states, as it's described today, but at least gets you on a diplomatic ramp. Keep the pressure on. Nobody's telling them stop the sanctions immediately. But in a give and take where you're actually giving something to the North Korean leader, he doesn't have to surrender right away. And a good example is Iran, just to come back to it, yep. where we combine sanctions with a realistic way out. And that's, you know, my philosophy of diplomacy is you have to give your adversary, your foe, your negotiating partner a realistic way out, one that may be tough for them to accept, but also tough for them to reject. And that's what happened with Iran. They didn't get everything they wanted, nor did we, but they didn't get everything they wanted. But it was a realistic outcome where they could preserve parts of their nuclear program, but scale it back considerably, slow it down considerably, shut down a lot of what they were doing so that we had the breathing space and the ability to say, okay, Iran is not on the verge of acquiring a nuclear weapon. That was important, and I think we have to take a page from that in dealing with any crisis. You marry forms of pressure with a realistic way out, and that applies to conflicts even that don't involve the United States. But history has shown that pressure alone in most cases simply leads your adversary to try to double down because they can't afford to look like they're buckling in, because then where does it end?
Yeah, so I see the approach, but I think there's one aspect of the Iran deal that also was critical, and you were there. You were in the administration as this was evolving. It seemed that there was an increasing amount of multilateral pressure mm-hmm. as well. In other words, it was not just the United States facing Iran, not just John Kerry facing Zarif, that there were other players with also aligning interests in this case. In the case of North Korea, it seems, although it's unclear because it's so opaque, certainly to a reader of newspapers or someone who's watching television, the degree to which China is also engaging. And so do we have a sense if of whether or not the current actions, whether they be of the administration or of other players, are performing in this multilateral sphere.
I don't want to. We could give credit to the Trump administration in this respect, that they have certainly got the attention of the Chinese and of the South Koreans and of others, the Russians. So, and of the North Koreans. So there's no doubt that the posture of the Trump administration has made China in particular think we got to take this seriously. When I speak to Chinese officials and when I speak to others, where again the criticism is not so much that they got their attention, it's that they're not, that the Trump administration has not yet been realistic in what it wants to do with that. Mm-hmm. So China is saying, okay, yes, we understand you're very concerned about what North Korea is doing. We're going to put more pressure on North Korea, which the Chinese have done, in some respects, unprecedented economic pressure by the Chinese on North Korea. But what the Chinese are telling us is, give a way out. In other words, let's have negotiations. Let's put denuclearization as the objective, but maybe a longer-term objective. Let's give Kim Jong-un a way to save face, to try to find a negotiated settlement. Because what the Chinese say is, even with all the pressure that we could put, we're not going to stop him from doing what he's going to do, unless there's a way out that he finds appealing. So we could try to starve the country. We could try to put all the pressure. The starvation is going to be felt by ordinary citizens well, well, well before they'll be felt by regime dignitaries. And this is a case where we know from history they won't hesitate to have millions die if that's what it takes, but they'll preserve the assets of the regime. So economic sanctions could get you someplace. They're not going to get you all the way. The threat of military action could get you someplace. It's not going to get you all the way because, again, this is not a regime that feels it could survive if it simply gives in to pressure. So what we hear from the Chinese is, okay, we put more pressure on North Korea, and they've deserved it because they violated Security Council resolutions by having missile launches and nuclear tests. But number one, let's negotiate. Number two, let's negotiate in a realistic way. What they're suggesting, which is very close to what Crisis Group has suggested, mm-hmm. is let's freeze aspects of North Korea's nuclear and missile program so that the fear that they're going to soon be able to reach the continental United States with a nuclear weapon will be abated. And at the same time, let's have the U.S. halt some of its military exercises, not all, but those that are probably deemed most provocative by the North Korean regime. And with that, let's have negotiations on a longer-term solution. That's very close to what the Chinese are saying. And the Chinese, I think, would be partners of the U.S. in that venture, and they'd keep the pressure on North Korea. Where they worry is that the U.S. is going to box the situation in a place where the military confrontation seems like the only way out, which would be a disaster for everyone.
Yeah, of course.
Try to find a way to put more time on the clock. That's the priority for us at Crisis Group, is put time on the clock, because right now, without any exits, we seem to be rushing towards this completely paradoxical situation of risking a nuclear war in order to prevent one, which really doesn't make any sense.
No, it really doesn't make any sense. And of course, as you say, it would be catastrophic.
Yeah.
Crisis Group is responsible for so much of looking at so many parts of the world. Let's take you to our part of the world, which is the Americas,
yeah.
and a nation that we're really concerned about. It's running towards elections in April. They are also an oil-rich nation, so maybe your Middle East expertise will give you an insight into Venezuela in a way that others don't have it, because they were a founding member of OPEC. But they are on the verge of collapse as well. They're certainly already at economic collapse, where they're experiencing 13,000% annual inflation rates, and people are without drugs, and food is becoming scarce. What is going on there, and how does your organization look at this, and whom do you then talk to try and come up with a resolution that prevents further disaster within that nation?
So a good case study, that we've done a lot of work on, and I think, again, some of the principles that we've been discussing now for the past hour apply there too. The presidency of President Maduro is obviously leading the country in a direction that is, as you just said, a economic collapse, political collapse, and with the risk, and we've already seen confrontation on the streets, that could get worse. And which is with the risk of spillover, of which we've already seen, and it's a spillover instability, spillover of migrants and of drugs. So yes, this is a case that, and a country that has a lot of resources, so it really is a double tragedy in that respect. So a few principles. Number one, that we do think that pressure needs to be put on the government to change its policies, to stop its repressive means, to stop its complete destruction of the constitutional order.
And some of that pressure is being put on, certainly, by the United States. Rex Tillerson just visited Latin America and suggested that military coup was in the was a potential action.
But I was going to say, the next principle is that internet pressure needs to be consensual. And you can't have one country that's talking about possible military intervention, another that's maintaining good ties with Venezuela, I'm thinking of Russia and China, others that are taking a middle ground. The key to, as you said earlier, in the case of Iran, the key to effective pressure is that it has to be coordinated. It has to be, so everyone has to give a bit. So that's number two. And then we've been arguing that there needs to be sort of a contact group, a group of countries, some of which have better relations with Venezuela, others less so, to work together, regional countries, to work together to try to put pressure on Maduro to head in a different direction. The third, again, is leave a way out. So yes, there needs to be some pressure, but the way out, we have to think of what kind of guarantees you'd give to members of the current regime if, in fact, they were not a coup, but through elections, through a constitutional means, a change in government, change of those in power, so that those who are currently holding power don't feel that they're going to be, their lives are going to be
strung up, essentially.
Exactly. So what kind of guarantees can you give? And there, you know, again, we're on the realistic edge of the non-governmental organizations.
Yeah.
There's always a debate about impunity, amnesty. Should you, you know, how can you not punish people and hold them accountable for what they did? And we understand that because it sets a precedent. At the same time, we believe that if you are so hard and inflexible on that principle, then you're giving no incentive for those in power to try to find a way to ease out. That's true of Bashar al-Assad, who has so much blood on his hands. Obviously, he should go in front of international court. But the question is, if you were given a choice, he's prepared to leave, but he wants to find some kind of safe haven somewhere and have sort of a peaceful transition of power, or he's going to stick to it forever. You know, that's a tough issue. And then our organization is one where we try to balance those things. We're not a human rights organization that is always saying you have to lean on the side of accountability and justice. We are not always prepared to sacrifice those, but to find a middle ground that gives those in power, like Maduro and the people around him, an incentive in the event we were in a negotiation where they were prepared to contemplate a transfer of power. What do you need to tell them? What guarantees do they need so that they're prepared to do that peacefully?
Right, and there are examples of having done this
Absolutely.
In the past, right? I mean, the Shah of Iran being one. I mean, that's just the first one that comes to my mind in the past. Are there others that you think of that are more recent?
There are many cases where this gets discussed. Again, they're always very controversial.
Yes.
But they do get discussed, and people, you know, many leaders have found safe haven in other countries. In the case of Tunisia, President Ben Ali found, at the time of the uprising, Saudi Arabia welcomed him.
Right.
He found some place to go. He's still there. And so he doesn't, you know, he didn't feel perhaps the need to fight his way to stay into power. But there are many other cases that one could think of where finding a way to take into account the fears of those who are currently in power. And it doesn't feel good. It
sure.
really doesn't feel good doing it. But it's better for us. The key principle is how to reduce violence and loss of human life and suffering. If we can do that, it doesn't mean at any cost. We're not prepared to do anything. But if that's your key objective, then some concessions to reality become more thinkable.
So to put you a bit on the spot, I know
Sure.
every year you do your top 10 hot spots. Can you name those top 10 hotspots for 2018, the places we should look at as potentially really horrible conflicts?
So I don't know that I'll get them in order, but
yes.
because the order may have shifted. But as I said, number one is North Korea. North Korea, it's number one not because we think it's the most likely conflict, but because if that conflict were, even if it's a 5% chance of conflict, it's a 100% disaster. And so we really need that we put that at the top. The second one is what we were talking about earlier, which is this network between Iran, Saudi Arabia, the U.S., Israel. You know, what could happen to the region as a whole? Myanmar, what happened with the Rohingya, is there because you have 700,000 people who are forcibly evicted from where they live. And it's not over yet because they're in Bangladesh and that's there's more instability that could be brewing. The situation in Yemen, which I mentioned earlier, again, a catastrophic situation. Ukraine, a frozen conflict, but which is, or a conflict that could be frozen, but is still active. We still, there's something that people don't know. There still are clashes going on, and it involves Russia, it involves the United States, and it's a place that we have to watch because it's the heart of Europe. Venezuela, we mentioned not long ago. The whole Sahel region, the region in Africa where you're seeing the superimposition of ethnic tribal clashes, terrorist groups, the erosion of state institutions, corruption, and that's a place that has known huge humanitarian catastrophes in the past. Syria, again, for reasons that we don't need to get into too much detail about, and I've lost count now. I don't know how many I'm at, unfortunately. So maybe you have it in front of you.
I could look.
I have to also say, and this is, you know, we always debate which should make the top 10.
Right.
And
unfortunately,
I'm waiting for the year where people say, we're stuck at 5.
Right.
Because we always have 15 or 20 that come to us, and it's a little bit arbitrary.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to make the decision in the end, and these were the 10. You probably have it in front of you.
I have Afghanistan, Republic of Congo.
Yeah. Afghanistan.
I think those are the two.
Those are the two. So yeah. Afghanistan, I would say we're in a period now where under the Trump administration, there's a belief we need to double down on our military strategy. It's born out of frustration. It's not born out of President Trump's own instincts. Paradoxically, he drew campaign on the notion that we've wasted money in Afghanistan, but he was convinced by his military that we needed to hit harder. Our concern is hitting harder means the Taliban are also going to hit harder, and that's what's happened. Again, we predicted, unfortunately, what we're seeing now, which is the Taliban resorting to urban terrorist warfare as a means of responding to the pressure. And our plea there is, don't forget diplomacy. This conflict has gone. It's the longest conflict in America's history. It's not going to be resolved through military means. If it was going to be resolved through military means, it would have been resolved when we had 100,000 troops there, not when we have 10 or 15,000. So let's not kid ourselves. The Taliban have gotten stronger. They're stronger now than they were when we had more troops. So by definition, this is an equation. Mathematically, it doesn't work. You got to sit down and talk to the Taliban. And we just had a... We just brought together a number of people to focus on Afghanistan. And one lesson that really... stuck with me, which is this. The United States today has more leverage and influence over the Taliban than it thinks it does, and it will have less than it believes it will in the future through military action. So it has more today than it thinks it does, and it will have less tomorrow than it hopes it will. And that's because the Taliban are not going to give in because they're bombed more. But they are under pressure today. There's no doubt about it. The leadership has been affected, has been attacked. So take advantage of that pressure. Sit down with the Taliban. See what you could do in coordination with the legitimate government of Afghanistan. But don't think that simply by bombing. I mean, the history of our nation, and not just our nation, is littered with the myth that by simply hitting harder, you're going to get your adversary to surrender. You don't have to go that far back. You go back to Vietnam, you go to Iraq, you go back to so many cases where this illusion, this myth is perpetuated, that it's just a matter of a little more force and they will suddenly come with their tail between their legs, our opponents will, and surrender. It just doesn't work. It wouldn't work against us, by the way, so why do we think it would work against them?
Rob Malley, International Crisis Group, thank you so much for being here. I guess the one place we really won't have to worry about too much in the future or currently is Scandinavia. But but I don't know if you're going to be looking and sending field representatives to Norway anytime soon.
No, we send out our fundraisers because they're very, very generous. But thank you. It really was a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We've just heard from Rob Malley. He's the CEO of the International Crisis Group, and he was in conversation with my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis of Stanford's Hoover Institution. And now to the second half of our program, which will feature Rory Carroll of The Guardian. Rory Carroll will share his perspectives as to how this once wealthy, oil-rich democracy devolved, first under the leadership of President Hugo Chavez, and now under President Nicolas Maduro. Rory will be in conversation with Jonathan Visbal, the chairman of World Affairs.
It's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's guest, Rory Carroll. He's been with The Guardian since the 1990s and covered Southern Europe, Baghdad, and Africa before spending 6 years covering South America from Caracas, Venezuela. Rory, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Jonathan, for the introduction and to the World Affairs Council for the invitation.
So let's start off with Venezuela and go back in history because Here you have a situation when you look around the world today that Venezuela's in our backyard. It's essentially a failed state. It's having tough times coming up with the foreign exchange reserves to pay off its bond debt. People are having a very tough time getting their money out of the bank. Inflation last year was 2,600%, and in December alone it was 85%. But in the 70s and the early 80s, Venezuela was a model for Latin American growth. It was a really amazing country. Talk to us about what Venezuela was like in the 70s and 80s and what brought us to the coup that President Hugo Chavez brought in 1992.
It's been an astonishing arc for this country, which had been, going back a century, a sort of tin pot dictatorship in a way. It was like a big ranch, and then they discovered oil. And so successive strong men were able to convert this into a lot of state patronage. And then it became this sort of modernist showcase in the 1950s. They put up a lot of skyscrapers, a lot of great architecture and innovations, and it became a sort of El Dorado. A lot of waves of immigrants from Europe, post-war Europe, came to Venezuela as this land of opportunity. And then through the 1970s, it was seen as this beacon of democracy, stability, and economic progress. And so to see where it is now, you would think, well, how could this possibly happen? And in one sense, it's that there are always dysfunctions within Venezuelan society and political culture. And partly this was due to the fact that it's a petrostate and had all of the ills of a petrostate. People call it about the resource curse, how dependence on one commodity can warp an economy and incentives, so that all the smartest people in the country and the most ambitious, instead of actually kind of making stuff and kind of creating value, they all are kind of gravitate towards rent seeking, trying to kind of get profit off at this oil sector. Anyway, this is a long-winded way of saying that the country then decayed and kind of warped a bit. So beneath this gloss of success, by the 1980s, things were beginning to go wrong. And this dual party democracy began to atrophy. And then when oil prices fell steeply in the 80s, they had no cushion. And that exposed the hollowness of the system. And so then enter Hugo Chavez as a lieutenant colonel in the army who stages a coup. Maybe I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but that's when Chavez explodes onto the national stage in 1992.
And so you had a situation where the facade was starting to break down. But what enabled Hugo Chavez to have the power to attempt a coup for which, as I recall, it was attempted, it wasn't successful, he went to jail for 2 years. But what gave him kind of the ability to rise up and take the audacious act of basically saying, let's bring down the government?
People were jaded, disgusted with the government, with corruption, and with the sense that the system was no longer working for them. And so when Chavez staged this coup, it was militarily, it was bungled. But he, as a communications genius that he was, he turned this fiasco into political success, because in surrendering, he went on television. And until then, he'd been unknown. He was just a military officer. But he had learned from Manuel Noriega's capture in Panama just a few years earlier. When Noriega was captured, you may remember, he looked bedraggled. He was in a T-shirt. He was very undignified. And Chavez had remembered that, so when he went surrendered, he made sure that he had his beret on, his uniform was crisp, he spoke very fluently, he's very articulate, and he took responsibility for the fiasco. And this actually electrified the country. People were like, my God, who is this guy? He seems almost like a romantic figure. And so that when he was sentenced, I think initially to people said he deserved 20 years in prison. 1 year for the coup and 19 years for failing. and this was yet against a democratically elected government. And so that was just the extent to which the system had then decayed. So when he did go to jail for just 2 years, he was then pardoned. And then he became a politician and was elected a few years later.
That's interesting. You know, I go back to a story. I remember when I was in Caracas in the late 80s, if you wanted to go out to dinner and you had a nice car, you had to find somebody and pay them to watch your car or your car was going to be stolen. And so that shows the decay that was happening in the late 80s right prior to the coup. Now, as we move into the 90s, though, he actually got elected in 1998. So what was it that was enabled him to, you know, come out of the coup and actually run for government and win in a democratic environment?
By the late 90s, people in Venezuela were even more disgusted with the state of the country because there had been, because oil prices had fallen and the whole country was so dependent on oil that the government's traditional levers of patronage had atrophied, and people were angry. And of the candidates on offer, he was by far the angriest, and he was a platform for people, or a vehicle for people's disillusionment with the system. And so he channeled that very effectively because he was such a talented communicator. He could speak to audiences and vary his tone of speech, and he just came across as very authentic. In a way, there are echoes, arguably, of the United States 2016, that people wanted a kind of an avenger, and he was the chosen avenger.
Interesting. And so talk to us about his policies. Once he got elected, what did he implement within Venezuela?
Well, initially, they were quite mushy. He was never quite ideologically as radical as either he led on or as his detractors would say. I mean, for example, he'd deny that he was a socialist for, I think, about 5 years, for the first 5 years. And he spoke about these kind of Blairite third way ways. He was a fan of Bill Clinton for a while. And it was only after the attempted coup against him in 2002 that he then became a bit more ideologically radical, became much more closer to Fidel Castro. And he imported help from Cuba to shore up his own government. So there was, at that point then, he saw these socialist policies, but the ruin of Venezuela of today really isn't rooted so much in the socialism as such. I think it's rooted in three separate elements. One is the populism, and this is a system of just giving money away. It was just a very populist way of shoring up your support by basically giving away gasoline for free to the entire country, by increasing government ministries and hiring lots of people, giving more people government jobs, and creating a huge panoply of patronage, which was super expensive and punctured holes in the economy, but he was doing it. Another policy or fatal flaw was this sheer managerial incompetence. Now that sounds quite banal when we're talking about system collapse and revolution, but the incompetence when you were there was just so extraordinary. It was on steroids of just how they could screw things up so badly. And they were able to get away with this because they had so much money, because Chavez's great luck was that he arrived into power, and soon after, oil prices exploded. I mean, they were about $8 a barrel when he took office, and then there went up in a trajectory, this kind of a decade-long rise up to more than up to $140 a barrel. So he had about $1 trillion to play with, $1 trillion over that period in a country of 30 million people who were actually not that wealthy. So he had a huge amount of money to spend, and he just burned through it. And in that time, he managed to actually during this time of extraordinary oil bounty, the national debt increased sixfold. So when you think of the amount of money, it felt like when you were in Caracas, it was like raining money on them. And so this created a whole new class of so-called boligarchs. This was a coinage of oligarchs and bolivarians. Yeah. And so it just was a system of, I'll give you one anecdote, and where one time he, on his television show, he had this weekly TV show, which could be like a 7-hour stream of consciousness, where he would go around and he would do things. And one Sunday morning, And we as journalists, we would always watch it because he would just make news. You never knew what he would do. And one morning, they filmed it in the center of Caracas. So it was like a mobile unit. And he was walking around the historic center of Caracas, being trailed by an entourage of ministers and aides and supporters. And he made it look spontaneous. And he kind of looked around and he pointed at a building and said, "Oh, what's that building over there?" And the mayor of Caracas kind of piped up and said, "Oh, well, that's a jewelry store, Mr. President." And then Chavez kind of feigns indignation because everybody knew this was actually very famous buildings. And he went, "A jewelry store? But you know, Simón Bolívar used to live there. This is outrageous that this is a jewelry store. Expropiense. Expropriate it." And, you know, the entourage like started were looking at it as if like expecting to see flames shooting out of this store. And then he turned on this and pointed another building. "And what's over there?" And the mayor said, "Oh, well, that's more stores." Chavez, "I'm so indignant. How can this kind of mammon here be, you know, intruding on this national heritage? Because Bolivar's aunt used to live in this building. No, expropriate it, because the national heritage, national dignity demands that we do this." And it was good kind of television and theater. But the point is that there was no plan B for that. So he expropriated these thriving businesses. And
including the oil industry, too.
And so yes, and this was like a microcosm of what happened nationally, which is within a few months, I went and visited what had been these thriving stores, and they were boarded up. There was like a teenage soldier sitting in front, and they're already looking derelict, and vagrants hanging outside, and they were shuttered. And Chavez had promised that they're going to build some great new kind of museums and make it a cultural hub and do all these great things. And instead, he just killed the business, killed all the jobs, and then it became just a derelict site. Now, you apply that on a macro scale to the oil company, the airlines, the factories that used to make cars, the agriculture. This was the pattern of just kind of making stuff up on the fly and then making a hash of it. And so that while they had so much money, it didn't seem to matter so much because they could always kind of buy their way out of trouble. But as we now see, eventually the money ran out.
And so now the Great Recession comes along in 2008, 2009. What happens in Venezuela? And of course, that's about the time when he's diagnosed with cancer, is it not? Because he passed away in 2013. But what's he do at that time where the oil prices collapse? Did his policies change, or how did he manage in that environment?
Well, again, he was very lucky with timing in that oil prices were staying just high enough whilst he was still alive. And the cracks were showing in the system. You could see it. I mean, I remember going out to with these agricultural co-ops in the countryside back in 2008, and you could see then the unfolding fiasco that they were trying to grow their own food and fix the agriculture. And as already, you could see it, that they were making a mess of it. By 2012, the economy was really having big problems. But Chavez, and this... he had almost had to kind of give full respect for this. He pulled off a double magic trick in 2012. Firstly, he was dying of cancer, but he pretended that he was cured. He said it was a miracle from God that he had been cured. And he then proceeded to campaign because there was an election in 2012. And he, in the advanced stages of cancer, was pretending to be cured. And he went on a stage. I remember this. It was extraordinary, and he was literally dancing. It was a pouring torrential tropical downpour, and he was one of the, like a sort of a victory rally in the last days of campaigning. Torrential downpours, and he was dressed in black, and he was on stage, and he was dancing. I mean, he was more energy than Justin Timberlake at the Super Bowl. I mean, seriously, you had to see the guy. He was dancing for hours. He was, he had this huge crowd in the palm of his hand, and he made jokes about the rain. And he projected the sense of immortality. And this was the guy, again, I repeat, he was months away from death and he'd been suffering. And he must have been in agony, in physical torment. And yet he was projecting the sense that he'd been cured. Simultaneous to this, the second magic trick was that the economy, meantime, was also on life support. But they borrowed a lot of money from China and they started printing lots of money and they confected a boom, And so they made it look like there was money more raining down in the economy, and so that they would be giving people free apartments, they'd be giving people free mattresses, free food, hiring people for more, creating another government ministry, here are more jobs, and so forth, to give this kind of feel-good effect, which was completely artificial and completely unsustainable, but it worked because he won. He won that last election when he was dying and the economy was about to go into a tailspin, and yet he actually won a majority of votes.
And then at that time, he hand-selected his successor, Nicolas Maduro, and Maduro came in without the same type of charisma, and now he's had to manage over the last 5 years in this environment. So what's that been like? You know, how does that transition take place, and how is he perceived in Venezuela?
It's become from a kind of black comedy to farce, to just pure tragedy at this point, because Maduro, I mean, he was unlucky in that all of the problems that Chavez had kind of successfully concealed through his wonderful capacity for theater and for distraction. I mean, I could give you 101 stories or examples of the way Chavez could just distract us, you know, from just like certain other presidents. He could pick ways to have us talk about something else other than, you know, the problems of the day. Now, Maduro firstly lacked Chavez's talent for distraction. He tries, but he just doesn't have Chavez's ability to the same charisma. Oil prices, of course, have fallen very steeply since Maduro took office. And thirdly, the accumulation of problems that Chavez had bequeathed to Maduro, for example, the price controls, exchange rate controls, and these may sound like kind of nerdy issues when you're talking about kind of the scale of the humanitarian disaster unfolding there, but actually exchange controls is one of the keys to understanding how Venezuela is so ruined. And what Maduro did was he made it worse. I mean, instead of having the pragmatism of Chavez, who always, despite the rhetorical thunder that he would give about the empire, he was always a lot more pragmatic than he led on, whereas Maduro was much more ideologically rigid and is also not as strong as Chavez had been in terms of taking unpopular decisions. So Maduro, instead of actually trying to introduce some kind of painful but necessary reforms, has doubled down, and so which of course has triggered a backlash among people who are now, because he is so unpopular, that we've seen the street protests. And whereas Chavez was always able to more or less stay on one side of authoritarianism, I mean, he was an elected autocrat, and to this day, forevermore, people will debate, was he a dictator or not? In my view, he wasn't. He was an elected autocrat. It was a hybrid. He didn't want to cross the line because he wanted the legitimacy of being elected and being seen to be popularly elected. Whereas Maduro can no longer afford that luxury, inverted commas. And so we now see these increasingly visible authoritarian steps taken by the government to simply retain power, to retain control. And that's what it boils down to now purely, is that the revolution is purely a rhetorical device for a group, the ruling clique, to retain power.
So what's it like living in Venezuela? If you're a common person in Venezuela today and you want to go about your business, buying food, sending your kids to school, what's that like for an everyday person?
Claustrophobic. I go back, my wife is Venezuelan, so my in-laws are Venezuelan. I go back to visit them. I'll tell you, when we travel now, frankly, it's like a traveling caravan, because the amount of stuff we bring. Now remember, this is a petrostate, the biggest oil reserves in the world, bigger than Saudi Arabia, relatively small population, verdant climate. In theory, they can produce all of their own food. They should be a food exporter. What we bring in our suitcases, we pack it with rice, cooking oil, toilet paper, pasta, medicines, bandages. And this is all the stuff that I used to bring to Havana. When I was based in Caracas and I would do reporting trips to Cuba, I had friends in Havana. I would bring also like shampoo and soaps, and then you bring them to friends in Cuba, and that would leave them. That's what we now bring to Venezuela. And I never thought, even when I could see the fiasco unfolding under Chavez, I never anticipated things could get this bad, where the it's complete collapse. And there's something called the Maduro diet, which is that now that food has become so scarce, that people have actually, on average, it's when studied, people have lost about 19 pounds of weight in the last 18 months. And you see it. I've seen it in my in-laws. I was shocked. I couldn't believe one of my in-laws, I mean, he shriveled. He always kind of a tubby guy. And now, I wouldn't say skeletal, but certainly it has that kind of lean, hungry look. And people are, because they simply don't have enough food. And we're talking about the middle class. And in this case, one guy, his pension used to be, as my brother-in-law, is like about $1,000, the equivalent. Now his pension is about $4 a month.
Wow.
$4 a month.
Because of inflation.
Yeah. Yes, inflation. And when you hear about inflation and hyperinflation, you see statistics like, oh, it's 200%, 900%, 2,000%. I mean, you know that's bad. But when you actually see the human cost, it's horrific. It destroys lives, literally so, because when you have families who can no longer afford medicines for example, for diabetes, epilepsy, and you have a child dying, choking to death because they can no longer afford medicines, which a year earlier they could afford, and now they can't. And you know, so people go on social media and that, and you know, they go like Radio Bemba to try to like figure out ways like to, you know, to sort out, to source medicines, and it's no longer working because the medicines simply aren't even there anymore. So to conclude on this, why it's claustrophobic, it's all of this is happening, and at the same time, you have this complete insecurity and crime, because at least in Cuba, at least it was in a proper dictatorship, the streets are more or less safe unless you're a political dissident. In Venezuela, that's not the case. It is, there are criminal gangs, like, right, the police are themselves often the biggest criminals. They moonlight as kidnappers. There's a de facto curfew by 6 p.m. People, if you have any sense, you go home because you don't want to be out on the streets at night. Because awful things happen, and now increasingly there are home invasions, so even in your own home, you're no longer safe. Thieves break into schools. If they hear that there's been a delivery of food to a school, they'll break into the school. They will steal the food. Two of my best friends in Caracas, they were broken into quite recently. Their neighbors were also broken into, and their neighbors were stabbed in their beds. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but the point is you have this system where you can no longer buy enough food, you can't get enough medicine, and you're actually afraid to go out because, you know, people, because of thieves. And just one last little anecdote is, it used to be in Venezuela and kind of macho culture and renowned for the beauty of its women, etc. And in Latin America, people now, when there are people walking down the street, people don't look at and, you know, give wolf whistles for the beauty of some perceived or otherwise of another person. They're looking at their bags to see if they got food. Not necessarily because they want to rob them, because if they see someone in the shopping bag and they see that they have flour or oil, their eyes will bulge. It's like, where did you get that? And people then get very self-conscious about carrying food, so you have to hide it. You have to triple bag it so people don't know it. And that's why it's incredibly claustrophobic. And so, frankly, I still love going back to Venezuela. Now it's a complete ordeal.
So what's the opposition party doing? I know Leopoldo López was put in jail, but does it have any strength? Is there any way that they can combat what has become a dictatorship now?
One of the reasons the government there is so entrenched, of many reasons, but one is that the opposition is fractious. They're perpetually infighting. They've always had a problem to relate, frankly, with the majority of Venezuelans. And the government, Chavez, was a master at this, and Maduro is actually quite wily as well at playing the oppositions off against each other, kind of divide and rule strategy. And so they, admittedly, the opposition has a tough task when some of their most charismatic candidates are disqualified. Either they're arrested and thrown in jail, they're hounded into exile, or they're accused of corruption and therefore they're disbarred from running for office. But they also have a capacity to shoot themselves in both feet. And so there is a sense of despair that the opposition really often just doesn't get its act together. And now they've got a horrendous challenge, which is that the government has called this snap election in April, which would be completely undemocratic because the government has the system is so rigged in favor of the government, and has been for many, many years. Successive elections have been rigged, but the rigging has got worse and worse and worse, to the point that now it's just completely blatant and shameless.
So what do you think the international community should do now? This is, you have a failed state like this, you're bound to get lots of people migrating, and they already are doing it, to Colombia. They'll try to get in the United States, et cetera. It's very similar to what's happening in the Middle East with Syria. What should the international community do?
Well, step number one, don't invade. Please do not invade Venezuela. It would be, ethically speaking aside, this would be a disaster. And I say that because there's been chatter. Rex Tillerson and Donald Trump have hinted at it, that maybe some military intervention and so forth. And that would just be a disaster, I think, for two reasons. One, the Venezuela does have its own military. They have also these kind of citizen militias. And the government does retain some support of maybe 20% of the population, maybe a bit more. So things get very messy. Sure, some Venezuelans are crying out for intervention / liberation, as they would see it. And they would throw rose petals on an invading force. But basically we would have seen this movie before, not in Venezuela, but it would not end happily. Secondly, even if there was a successful regime change in terms of toppling it, such that the successor governments would be seen as illegitimate in the eyes of many Venezuelans, and it would be tarred with the original sin of Yankee intervention, gringo imperialism, and certainly the rest of the region could not possibly tolerate or give a pass to this intervention. So, and maybe the third reason I think this will not happen is that Venezuela's tragedy in many ways is self-contained, because yes, there is some spillover. We see now this historic reversal of Venezuelan refugees basically spilling over into Colombia, as after decades of Colombians as refugees come in seeking refuge in Venezuela, the traffic is now reversed. Likewise, Venezuelans seeking refuge in Brazil. I've come across Venezuelans in Mexico now doing jobs that Venezuelans would never previously have considered. But so far it's been the flight of the middle class, and they're the ones who are able to get out. And so it's not a humanitarian catastrophe of the boat people yet, and it may never quite reach that stage. So it's not like the international community has to intervene for the sake of its own national security, because a bit like, say, in Haiti or, say, in Congo in Africa, where tragedy might unfold, but it doesn't necessarily mean spell disaster for the rest of the region. And in a way, that's bad news for Venezuelans, because it means that the rest of the international community can, to some extent, afford to sit on its hands and just let the tragedy play itself out.
I'd like to say good night to our radio listeners and thank Rory Carroll for his excellent discussion. Many thanks as well to you, the audience, for your terrific questions. And now I'd like to give a round of applause for Rory. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. In the first half hour of this program, we featured Rob Malley, CEO of the International Crisis Group. And in the second half hour, we heard from Rory Carroll of The Guardian. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.